The title of today's sermon is Real Men Pray. Now, I think we've got this. Is it working? We're going to try to get this working. I have just, once again, a few little pictures I want to show you. There's a reason why real men pray, and we're going to talk about that today. But there is an image of God, there is an image of Christ that sometimes that we have, and it's been in our minds for a long time, and it tends to influence us. What do we have up here? Still, okay, we ready, still, there we go. Now, we have certain pictures of an image of Christ. These pictures, of course, have been concocted some centuries after Jesus came. These are not the real pictures, but they're ideas in people's heads as to what Jesus really looked like. Can we have another one? And there we go. There's yet another one. And here is, of course, the Lion of Judah. Here is the great warrior, Christ. Who fights on behalf of his people, the one who has predicted great calamities that's going to come upon people, the one who is going to be fighting wars. This is Jesus. We have another one? There we go. Now, here is Jesus receiving strength from an angel. This is, once again, a person's idea as to what happened. And it's not, first of all, angels don't look like that. Angels doesn't even come close, according to the descriptions in the Bible. And I don't know how much strength he would be receiving from him anyway. We have a little problem here, folks, as to some of the images that just keep coming across to us from the Christian church that give us an impression as to who God is, who Jesus is, and lo and behold, let's have the next one. Yeah, that one too. Sorry, I forgot that one was in there. You know, there we are. A Savior. How would you like to be delivered from trouble? From this? I mean, you're not going to get it. It's just not there. That one. Now, look. If you were really in trouble and you needed to be saved, I mean, your life needed to be saved, do you want him or her or it to come to your rescue? I think we've got a little problem here, don't we? All right. Once again, this is not even close. Yes, again. Now, this is a little bit more like it. This is right out of the Gladiator. Jesus Christ is pictured. He's pictured this way. I want to give you another side of this. And we need to explore this. Jesus Christ is pictured as a warrior on a horse. I don't know what color his is, but that's Russell Crowe. They made him look reasonably tough there. And all of his warriors are ready to fight. Now, we've been talking a little bit about that because it's important to understand the situation we're in. And the last two sermons I've given to you does describe the situation the Church of God is in. We are in a hostile situation. We're in a world that's ruled by the devil. He is enraged against the woman, the church. He'll do anything he can to deal with us. Let's have, there we are, gladiators, and I think there's one more. I think you get the picture. In other words, you want these kind of guys on your side, not the first one. So we have a little problem here. In simply the caricature of who and what we think God is. I think that's all we need. That is, that's supposed to be a gladiator, I suppose, of one kind or another. We just pulled these off the internet, but it simply kind of gives you an idea and kind of shows a little bit of a contrast. The pictures we have seen, the pictures I grew up with, perhaps you grew up with, and the churches I went to, right on the wall, there was a picture like we first saw. Now, we know that somehow we have seen, we've sensed that the role of men has been diminished and under attack within our culture. And people grow up with certain images in their minds that come from a number of sources. The Christian church is one of those sources. It's not the only one. But the role of man, of a man, and who he is, who he should be, how he should conduct himself, what his role is in society, has certainly been diminished. It has been distorted. And it comes from a number of sources. But the Christian church, and these, as I said, this religion is one of the worst. These pictures seem to imply that Jesus Christ, who is the creator, he is the ruler of the entire universe, when he came to this earth, that he looked like this, and worse yet, he acted like those pictures imply. A man who's battered from turning the other cheek after showing nothing but love, was turned on, led away like a sheep without a whimper, and trying to give the idea, this is the way Christian men ought to live. And when Jesus talked about some of the principles of blessed are the meek, or blessed are the poor in spirit, or he talked about turning the other cheek, it had to do with not returning evil for evil. That's the idea as to what he was trying to tell people. He wasn't saying, this is the way you need to be and to live at any and all cost to you and to your family. Now, a couple of quotes here from a book called The Heart of a Tender Warrior, written by a man by Stu Weber. He says, why is it when someone says, picture the archetypal male, the image that comes to mind is not one of Jesus. I have to confess that for years, the picture in my mind would not have been Jesus. Even the single most famous portrait of Jesus makes him look more like a pouting model for Breck shampoo than a man. All right, here's one from very interesting. This is their observation from a book of the Christian Rite of Passage to Guide Boys into Godly Manhood. Makes this comment, Jesus was a gaunt, pasty, white creature hidden under mounds of flowing robes. His hair was long, thin, and stringy. He was painted to look strained, tired, and supplicant. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, soft and suspiciously effeminate. It often seems as if the church is working in collusion with a culture bent on emasculating men and turning raw male material into pliable, defanged images of its own liking. And let me just say, when you do that, you do it to your own hurt. And because the church, that is the Christian church, in general, simply doesn't fare very well in this world. And you have to resist in your own mind and these kinds of images. Now, some of these ideas dominate the teachings in the churches. And it is in the Christian church that a lot of these false images are fostered, even generated, as I suggested in the first place. Who do you think came up with these pictures that have proliferated all over the world? Who do you think would be served best if a person had in their mind of a Jesus who is so weak that he is simply not able to save? Who do you think would benefit if the very pictures of Jesus themselves would turn away people from the Christian faith? Well, someone would benefit from that, and that's the very one who has actually fostered these ideas to start with. But it has an effect on our men, all Christian men who have a false image of the Son of God. They have a false image of the apostles and what they are. I didn't even show you pictures of the apostles. They look a little better, but not by much. And somehow they try to tell you that the New Testament is so totally different from the Old Testament. When you start looking at some of the men of valor, the warriors from the Old Testament. And I want to try to show you that, wait a minute, I think we've got a problem here. And the way God is being pictured, the servants of God sometimes are being pictured, angels are being pictured. And it has a terrible effect in, let's say, your relationship with God himself. Now, as I said, I've been trying to get us to see a different picture of God, try to get us to have a different understanding of God and this world, the ruler of this world, God's adversary, what he is doing and who he is, and what it is we have to deal with. God is a God who acts. God is a God who delivers. God is one who fights. God is the one who is the head of his armies or hosts. He is indeed the head of his church. He sends his forces into this world on behalf of his people. Here's a God who is a God of purpose and decision. And he's able to make those decisions. In fact, he had a plan and a counsel right from the very beginning. This tells you a lot about God. And there is something that stops men from entering into a relationship with their God. Men who have been called by God, men who sometimes don't understand their calling or their responsibility to their families and to their community in their relationship with God. And man does have, every man right here who's been called by God has a responsibility before God in what and who he is and what he is, to stand on behalf of his family, to stand on behalf of his church, to stand on behalf sometimes of his community, and sometimes on behalf of his nation, for that matter, against their enemies. I think we need to look at some things where God set man to do in his role, and especially within the family. And here is, of course, where we have the greatest problem, is that men tend to have, diminished from, they have relinquished, they have abdicated from their rightful position the way God created it in the first place. We're going to see some of these statements in the Bible as we go through that. Let's consider a few examples, and let's check out the other side of Jesus, meek and mild, as it were, the one who turned the other cheek, and tried to understand what is really going on here. Luke chapter 4, verses 16 through 37. I realize it's quite a long passage, but let's get into it. I think we can demonstrate some points here. Luke 4, 16. Often quoted scripture about what Jesus came to do. But it tells us a lot here, too. So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to recover sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." Then he closed the book, and he gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, you might say, well, everything is okay up until this point. Jesus wasn't content to let it stop there. There's more he wanted to say. He began to say to them, "Today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." So all bore witness to him and marveled at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said more than that, is this not Joseph's son? In other words, how could it possibly be the son of Joseph, whom we have known, could say such things as this? Who does he think he is, saying, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, he has anointed me"? And these things are actually fulfilled this day in your very eyes. And so they were resisting what he had to say. Then he said to them, he could have sort of left it at that. Says, okay, that's how you feel about it. That's fine. I'll be a nice guy and leave. That's not what he did. He said to them, "You will surely say this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.'" And that's exactly what they were saying. "Whatever we have done in Capernaum, do also here in your country." Then he said, "Assuredly, I say to you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you truly, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a great famine throughout all the land. But to none of them was Elijah sent except to Zarephath in the region of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And many lepers were in Israel at the time of Elisha the prophet, and none of them were cleansed except Naaman the Syrian. You know what he's saying to him? He says, you better wake up, because there's a reason why nothing's happening right here in your congregation. You're sitting here, and it's a do-nothing, nothing-happening kind of a group. It's been that way since I was a kid. That's what he's saying. And so I came here to tell you some things. You know exactly what I do. You know exactly what I've been doing. And he says, you don't want to accept it. These are pretty straight words. He says, you're not even close to coming to any kind of faith or belief as to what God is doing, and you don't want to know. That's what he said to him. I'm just kind of put it in what he said. He said, God is not working here. So all those in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath. Why didn't Jesus just sort of leave it at that? You know, why did he have to say this? And he rose up. So they rose up. They thrust him out of the city. They were mad. They manhandled him out. And they led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down over the cliff. They have blood in their eyes. And passing through the midst of them, he went his way. What does that mean? I got a feeling they took him so far, and he says, that's it. I don't think this critter that you saw in the first three pictures had the capacity to do that. I think if that's the way Jesus was, they'd have succeeded in throwing him off. Matter of fact, I don't think that picture is one person who would have stood up to the whole group and pointed out to them clearly what their spiritual deficiency was and what kind of an attitude and spirit they had allowed right there within their congregation. Later he went back to his own country. In Mark chapter 6, I'm not going to read that. He conducted himself in a particular way. And it says, they were offended. You see, he just wasn't politically correct. He didn't fit their image of what a person should be if he's going to be a servant of God. Mark 3, verses 20 through 35. What could he have been doing to have garnered all of this criticism? Mark 3. He said, the multitude came together, and so they could not so much as eat bread. But when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold on him, for they said, he is out of his mind. Now that was his own people, his own family, saying, I don't know what's wrong with Jesus. He's out of his gourd here, you know, and what he's doing. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem, and they said, he has Beelzebub. And by the ruler of demons, he cast out demons. That's serious to say that. So he called them to himself, and he said to them in parables, how can Satan cast out Satan? Now he did. He seemed to be a little bit more patient here in explaining it to them. But he goes on and explains to them that they're really not doing the will of God. And he says, you're not really my brothers and sisters. He tells his own family that. And he says, the ones who are my brothers and sisters are the one who does the will of God. Wow. So he's got the scribes and Pharisees turned against him. He's got his brothers and sisters turned against him. Jesus doesn't sound like a really nice guy to me. Not in reading this anyway. There's another side to Jesus we ought to look at. Jesus was confronting, whether it be in the synagogue, whether it be amongst his own family, whether it be in the multitudes that followed him and looked for whatever he could do for them. He was confronting evil. He was confronting hypocrisy, pretense, false teachings, anything that stood in the way of people knowing the true God. He was doing things like healing people, really showing up the other religious people for who they were and who they claimed they were. He was confronting demons, who really are the cause of all of this anyway. And, you know, the idea is, well, you don't want to upset people too much. You surely don't want to upset these demons. After all, you get them on your back. Let's leave them alone. Jesus didn't worry about it. He dealt with them when he saw them. You know, the pagan religions do that. They try to appease the false gods. And they bring all kinds of, what, sacrifices and gifts to them and say, well, hopefully they won't be angry at me today. Tell me the difference. You see, Jesus understood who he was. He understood the situation. He understood how people were really duped into agreeing to a passive, go-along kind of a religion. Don't rock the boat. Let's just let things go, and everything is going to be okay. Christian men really need to get rid of the notion that Jesus was perpetually mild and easy to get along with. He wasn't always easy to get along with. He called his enemies a brood of vipers fit for hell. Pretty tough language, isn't it? He called them whitewashed tombs. He used some pretty coarse language when being critical of authority figures. He was irreverent and he was disrespectful, if you understand the type of language he used, to people who had always expected and received respect from those around them. Yet, we want to retain, let me just make one other comment. He referred to Herod, a king, Herod, as that fox. So you go tell that fox this. That wasn't a good term, by the way, incidentally. But we want to retain this character of Jesus as being endlessly patient. He turned to his disciples on one time, seemingly exasperated, and said, how long must I be with you until you believe? How long do I have to put up with you? That's from Matthew 17:17 from the New Living Translation. That's how it's translated. Jesus was not forever long-suffering. If he was, he would be forever enslaved to the way everybody else was if he did. He did use some provocative language that shocked and offended even some of his followers. But he made them think. He had to make them think what the situation was. He had to make them think where they were. He had to make them understand then what the real picture was. He gave a parable of the fig tree, for instance, and after 3 years, he says, if it doesn't bear fruit, tell the gardener to cut it out. Whoa, that's pretty tough, isn't it? Another time, he cursed the fig tree. I read an article years and years ago, actually from 40 years ago, I remember it came out in the paper. I think I still got it, one of my yellow files, because they all turn yellow. That's how old it is. Where it says, the scholars have found where Christ lost it. He lost control and he cursed the fig tree. Well, he was teaching them a lesson. But you have to understand there's another side of things. His disciples, who all fled when he was arrested, they folded. They folded on him. No matter what they said, they folded right then and there. When the authorities came for him and arrested him. Now, they began to get the idea later of the kind of person they ought to be. Because he says, guys, you're on your own now. Now, I'll be there to help you, but you saw what I did, now you do it. Whoa, their eyes got real big on that one. So, Peter, who is at that point is full of faith, heals a person. And when he's told he shouldn't be preaching in the name of Jesus, when they told him not to, he says this. He's in a court with all of these so-called important people, and he looks up at them, supposingly he's looking up at them, but they're on some kind of a bench somewhere, and there's a lot of them, that he says, you know, I hear what you say, but I'm going to obey God before I obey you. Now, I don't know if anybody else was in the courtroom who may have said, Peter, can you kind of keep it down a little bit? They're letting us out. Don't make it worse. Peter says, sorry. I don't know if they did that. I don't think they did. I think all the apostles said it. I think they agreed with him at that point. Tell them, Peter. I know we got an open door and we can walk out right now. Peter doesn't keep his mouth shut. He says, we're going to obey God before we obey you. He says, that's the situation. And he says, and let me tell you something else. God hasn't given you the Holy Spirit. He's given it to us who are obeying him. What's more? That's what he told them. Now, you can go back and read it to yourself and kind of see the situation there. But here, his disciples then began to get the idea that they had a real leader, and that was Jesus Christ. And they were going to follow him. And they weren't afraid of mincing words. You see, something changed. They began to get the real picture, not a wrong picture. There was Stephen then, who told them when they hauled him before their council, he says, you are stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears. He said, you always resist the Holy Spirit as your fathers did. Your fathers persecuted the prophets and killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become betrayers and murderers, and have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. Somebody probably would have said, now, Peter, you know, you got to be careful how you answer here. This could be very serious, you know. That's not the way he saw it. He says, this is it. This is it. I'm here for this reason. And he was prepared to stand up for what he believed. And God backed him up and supported it by giving him a vision of Jesus Christ standing on the right hand of God. Paul confronted Peter to his face. He did that in an appropriate way, but he did it in front of people. Paul didn't mince words with people either when preaching the gospel. We have example after example. When he walked into various towns, he began to teach about Jesus Christ. He had to. He had to do it in such a way to where people would sit up and take notice. That's simply the way he did it. And I know a lot of people say, well, let's look at Mars Hill. Here is the complete and total epitome of tact, diplomacy. I think he said this, if you want to read it. He says, there's going to come a day when God's going to judge everybody, and you need to think about this. And everything that you're doing out here by serving these gods is not going to amount to a hill of beans. I think you ought to go back and reinterpret it a little bit and say, what did he really say? Paul, when talking to Philemon, remember that story? Such a nice story, we're told. Here Paul is saying, you know, he used such tact to try to win Philemon over and say, you know, I'm sending him back to you. I know you're in, and I know that you will just do what a wonderful approbation, what a wonderful, trying to build Philemon up to the point where he would go along with Paul. You know what Paul says? I'm sending him back. Well, I want you to treat him right because, and I'm telling you this because you owe me one, Philemon. Go back and read it. That's what he was really saying. What I'm saying is this, that they try to put a lot of things that are being said in ways that is not really said. Paul tells Timothy, look, I'm just picking out a few, picking the eyes out of it. There's a lot more to it than this. But Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 3 and 4, and from the New English Bible, if anyone teaches otherwise and will not give his mind to wholesome precepts and to good teaching, I call him a pompous ignoramus. So what do we have here? What are we looking at when we take a look at this side of things? Christ and his disciples are confident. They know who they are. They are not affected by the forces of this world, either human or spiritual. They know where they stand, and they know the real situation. They know it's not going to be a nice time. They know that they are men in God's service, and they know their leader. These were the leaders. These were the leaders that Christ chose. He said, follow me. He said, it's not going to be easy. In fact, you're going to have to give up everything. You know, I always kind of wondered what an ad would be if Jesus had placed an ad in the local Palestinian paper and advertised for his original disciples. Needed 12 men. You will be prosperous. Things will go well for you. God will bless you. You will be liked by all men. Whatever. Look, Jesus didn't say that. He said, he talked pretty straight to them all throughout his ministry. But initially, he says, here's what you need to do right now. You need to give up everything. Walk away from it now. He says, here's the deal. You guys are fishermen. I'm going to make you fishers of men. You're either in or out. Now, that's the answer. So what's your answer? That was it. This is pretty tough, isn't it? How could Jesus say these kind of things? Now, I hope I'm not exaggerating too much on this, but I think there is another side of this. Look, all of life does not require you to be that direct. No, it doesn't. Jesus was not always that direct. He explained things. He was patient at times. I don't mean to imply that he wasn't. I simply want to point out another side of things. Sometimes life does require us to be direct, straightforward. Give that answer. Give it the first time. Give it straight up. But if you're not what you should be, you could never handle the conflicts, the hardships, the reverses in life, and the criticisms that you'll get. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8. Let's go to the scripture from which the title of this sermon is given. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8. I desire, therefore, that the men, he's not talking about every man, the men in the church he's talking about. Now he's talking about men and women in the church. If you've got a New King James Bible, you may have that as your heading. But the men and the women in the church. That the men pray everywhere, not just at the temple. They pray where they need to. Doesn't matter where it is. Lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. Holy hands. You get the idea that a man here is leading the way, beseeching God about matters of themselves, about matters of their church. That's the context. What is going on in their church? Their families in the church. Their families and the church in the community, and their and the leadership of their country. If you'll notice verse 1, he says, I exhort, first of all, that supplications and prayers and intercessions and the giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in godliness and reverence. Okay, men, he says, and once again, the title of the sermon is, Real Men Pray. Men in the church, holy hands, and you do so here without wrath and doubting. Men who take the leadership, who accept the responsibility of leadership, but under the leadership of their head, Jesus Christ and God. They lead in prayer. Real men lead in prayer. They stand before God, accepting their responsibility, accountable to God for their responsibility as the one who is a provider, a protector of their families and of their church. Now he adds one thing here. He says, without wrath and doubting, which I've already alluded to. Here are the two great issues that plague men. One, wrath. Second, doubting. Now, the books, the psychologists will tell you this, that here is how men who have had troubled upbringings, men who have a hard time understanding who they are, deal with two great issues. Anger, speaks of wrath here, and then the other side of the coin, doubting. Wrath. Men who have been taught to be something other than men. They find it difficult to cope in their world. Sometimes take out their frustration in wrath. It manifests itself in the form of abuse, sometimes physical, unfortunately, verbal, and emotional. They've got to be in charge. They're dealing with their insecurities. Simply because they've never learned to be secure, they never learned to move and operate in their world, the world of a man, out in the world. These guys blow sometimes. They're into rage. People who are into road rage, men. Why? There's something underlying here, a lot of anger there sometimes. They become aggressive, become belligerent. As a child, they could have been a bully. As grown men, they don't know how to deal with the conflicts in their life. So they deal with their inabilities, the inabilities that they sense within themselves through wrath, through anger. And it comes out in a myriad of forms. Doubting is the other side of the coin. There are then those who lack confidence, who are unsure about themselves and the world. They learn to simply take what's handed to them, never learning to be the master of their lives. Many times they're just nice guys. They've learned to act in a certain way that they know is good, or they've been taught is good and right and proper. They've been taught that. All the while, never being able to deal with uncertainty in their lives, compromising with life, never dealing with issues in their world. They have a hard time making decisions. The big issues in their life simply don't get settled, never have been settled. They don't know what they should be doing. Their family suffers, they suffer, because that's what they're supposed to do, to simply be nice and accept what comes their way. Many times it's a mixture of both. There's anger along with doubting. The real issue here is that a man struggles with who he is in the world. But this is something that a man should not really have to struggle with. For the simple reason, it is the man who is in the world who represents his family to the world. It is the man then who is the protector and the provider of his family. He's the one with the strength. He's the one with the broad shoulders. He is the one who, if there's any assault against the family, he takes that as his responsibility. He deals with the conflicts in the world. His wife's not made for that. She does other things, as we're going to see here in just a moment. And she's got her own battles to fight. But the man cannot abdicate the position that God put him in, and that is to stand against anything that comes against his family in the form of evil, falsehood, wrong teaching, wrong influences, no matter what form it comes into the house or the home. This is the guy who's supposed to stand against it. That's who he is. Now, unfortunately, men have failed to understand their position in the sight of God. And they have permitted all kinds of things to take place. And the woman, many times, has become the moral leader, certainly the emotional leader within the family. And so many things revolves around her. You've heard the saying, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. I think we got a little problem here, folks, don't you? I think we do have a problem here. The way this thing gets turned around. The man was formed first. Let's go ahead and read this. I'm skipping ahead. In like manner, also. Now we have something for the women. Now let me just say, this is not to the women. You say, well, I wish the women were here. Well, I'm talking about men. You know, we wrote a paper on women's roles, and we quoted a lot of this. I think we should write one on men's roles, straight out of the same scriptures. I think that would go a long ways to answer a lot of the questions. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair of gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. And so there is a certain way that she conducts herself, but the way that she should deal with whatever insecurities or problems or issues that she deals with now should not be in trying to draw attention to herself by being improperly dressed, as it were. And he says, that's not what you should do. And some women deal with issues in their life in that way. They have many other ways in which they deal with issues, but that's one of them. Paul says, it's not the way it should be. Let's understand in a very serious way what men ought to be and then what women ought to be. Let a woman learn silence with all submission. Now you might, and I ask myself, why am I reading the scripture? Why am I getting into this today? Of all the scriptures I could use, yeah, I got to read this. You might say, well, you're pretty brave. All the women are up. Not all the women. Some of the women are right here. Let's read it. Let's get the context here. Let a woman learn silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. What's he talking about? He talks about in the church. It doesn't mean to be silent when you walk in. It's just silent with respect to the formal teaching that goes on in the church. That's what he's talking about. And he's very clear on this. And I realize that deconstructionists have changed all that around and say, well, God, he's actually trying to say something else about women, which is not true. These statements are very clear when you understand how it is to be within the church, with men and with women. There's a reason for that, and I'll cover this in just a moment. For Adam was first formed, and then Eve. So he appeals right back to the creation. Who was formed first? Adam. When was Eve formed? Let's read on. Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression. Now, what you got to do is go back and just get the original, what took place right there in the Garden of Eden. God says, let us make man in our image, and so he created a man. Didn't create a woman then, he created a man. I'm not saying a woman's not in God's image. Not saying that at all. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, when he said that, he created a man. And then when he created the man, he instructed the man. And when he got finished instructing the man on everything, then he created the woman. God never instructed the woman. He instructed the man. Now, she was able to quote what God said to the serpent, with only one slight variation, which was okay. But how did she know? Because Adam told her, which is what he should have done. But Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived, fell into the transgression. Now, the man was formed first, then the woman, but something happened that men simply don't take responsibility. And you have to ask the question, she was on her own, a situation she should never have been in, and she had to take on the ruler of this world. How fair is this? How fair is it that Eve has to take on the wicked, evil, powerful, cunning, subtle ruler of the world? A whole lot smarter than her. When Adam himself heard what God had to say personally. Not a good deal going on here, guys. What's the man's role? What should he do? Where should he have been? I don't know where he was, but you know, if somebody comes to your house, an irate neighbor or something, and he knocks on the door and says, look, I got a problem with your dog, and he starts carrying on about it, you know what your wife ought to say? She said, look, sir, would you mind coming back when my husband's home? She does not have to fight the battle for her family to the world. She just simply doesn't. That's not what she's made for. She doesn't have the broad shoulders. He was made to represent the family to the world. And certainly in areas of conflict such as this. But many times it's left up to the woman to do so. She's got to fight the battles. She's got to take people on. She's got to set the standards with respect to what comes across on that television or the computer or whatever. You know, it would be so much easier if Dad would simply say, "Okay, guys," I'm saying if they're boys, "here's the way it's going to be." He sets the rules. It's a lot easier for Mom to back him up. What does a guy do if you say, "Well, whatever your mom says"? How's that sound? You guys go for that? I don't think it's right. Now, I'm not saying she couldn't. But I'm telling you, God put man in a certain position. Where's the broad-shouldered protector? Where's the man who should have stood up at a time like this? Where was the one who was created first and given the instruction? Where was the one who had a relationship with God? But obviously, not a relationship that was good enough. Otherwise, he would have known. Because he hid. And then he blamed her. You could see right there and then, things were not going to go well for these two for the next 936 years. How would you like to live like that? And every argument there ever was would come right back to this. I don't think they had such a good life. And the result of Cain, I think, kind of proves it. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. Look, that's right. There's something that the man needs to be doing. And he represents his family, and he protects his family to the world. And he provides for his family to the world. She, it's very interesting what it says here, will be saved in childbearing. You know, she's got her battle to fight too. He has his. She can't fight his battle. And neither can he fight hers. You ever? And a man needs to be with his wife when she has her children. As the old Seventh-day Adventist midwife said to me the first time we visited her and asked her, "Would you deliver our child?" And she said, "Yeah, are you going to be there?" I said, "Suppose." She says, "Well, you ought to be. You ought to see what you started." I said, "Oh, okay." Now, it so happened, this she was an old Seventh-day Adventist midwife in Morganton, North Carolina. She delivered over 1,500 babies and lost only one, and she delivered a lot of them in the worst possible conditions, out in the woods, you say bush here. No doctors anywhere around. She knew how a baby ought to be born, and she did it under every kind of worst possible conditions. She had a record that doctors in the hospital couldn't even begin to match. I'm sitting there. The first labor is a long one. Now, what do I know? Here's what I do. There's another bed. I take a nap. While this is going on, I wake up, it's still going on. So we have the baby, go through it. So I said, so the phone there. And so I'm sitting on the side of the bed. And so I called my mother, and she wanted to know. I said, "Oh, yeah, it's a boy. How did Jenny do?" "Not a problem. It was okay. It was easy." The midwife almost slapped me off the bed. She said, "If you were in a hospital, this would have been a cesarean." I said, "You now, It took me five to understand a lot. Maybe that's why God says you got to have five kids. You got to understand a lot more. She shall be saved. She's got to fight her own battle. That's what this means. She's going to be saved in doing what she has to do. This is not easy, having a baby. And men that need to understand likewise that they need to bear themselves the burden of her protector and to provide for her and make sure she does not have to fight those kind of battles. The women's lib says, well, she can fight right alongside of a man in a man's world. She can do everything she wants. That's what the women's lib say. Well, that's a reaction, unfortunately. Let me make this one point clear. It's the men who should be taking the battle to the enemy. They were the ones God made to stand against everything that is harmful, false, and destructive of the devil. They are the moral and spiritual protectors of their families, and fathers cannot check out of the job they were given. And that's exactly why I believe that the devil has inspired an attack on men and the role of men in society and in the family. I want to read to you from Department of Health and Human Services report that says this. Fathers play a unique role in fostering the well-being of their children, not only through providership, protection, and guidance, but also through the way that they nurture the next generation. There's a catch in this. The report also states a father's involvement with his children is powerfully contingent on the mother's attitude toward him. Research on children consistently indicates that the father-child relationship, even more than the mother-child relationship, depends on the quality of the parent's relationship. You see the snag? Now, here's what the report continues to say. Girls with active dads demonstrate higher levels of mathematical competence. Boys with more nurturing fathers display a higher level of verbal acumen. It is worth noting, of course, that girls tend to struggle more with math and boys tend to struggle more with language. Having an active, emotionally invested father appears to help children overcome the intellectual weaknesses typically associated with their sex. Fathers are more likely to foster independent, exploratory behavior on the part of their children compared to mothers. Children raised by engaged fathers are more comfortable exploring the world around them. A playful, challenging, and nurturing approach to fatherhood is associated with more self-control and pro-social behavior among children throughout the course of their lives. One study of seventh graders found that boys who had close relationships with their fathers were more likely to control their feelings and impulses, to obey rules at school and at home, to make good moral judgments. The same study found that boys with involved fathers had fewer school behavior problems and that girls had more self-esteem. Boys and girls who are exposed to the nurture of a father and to see a father being nurturing to their mother and other adults are much less likely to associate masculinity with predatory sexual behavior and hyper-aggressiveness. Fathers help their children, especially their daughters, develop the self-control and the sense of self-worth that protects them from premature sexual activity and teenage pregnancy. And we've said that for a long time. Here it is, a report. This is not isolated evidence. The documentation of this kind of resource, this information is all out there, that they feel very secure in who they are. And especially girls, they don't need to run immediately to Wolfman, who's going to wind up getting them pregnant, and they wind up in some kind of relationship or situation, simply because they don't know who they are. Now, but we all sense that there's an attack by a society, a culture within our civilization that is influenced by the devil. 1 Timothy chapter 3, it talks about the position of a bishop. One of the things it says here, verse 5, if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Now, that's a principle we have violated so many times, it's not funny. It says of a deacon, let the deacons be husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their houses well. the way they're supposed to be. In other words, the man hasn't checked out. He is then the spiritual protector. In 1 Corinthians 11, we're going to get down to understand why this is the case. 1 Corinthians 11. And help us to understand a little bit more about what a man is and what a man should do. Verse 2. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and to keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, that the head of a woman is the man, and that the head of Christ is God. Now we could stop right there, but let me just point out to you that he gives here a certain order that he has set up. And it's so important that you understand it. And men need to understand who they are in the order of dominion. If I can put it that way, we read that, we had that hymn. He is over every dominion. And then he has set certain things in the universe, as it were. Then, simply because it has these implications. The head of every man is Christ. The head of Christ is God, and the head of the woman is man. Every man praying or prophesying with his head covered dishonors his head. Now, he's giving some instructions here because he wants to make a very important point. Every man praying or prophesying having his head covered. What's he talking about, a covering? He's not, get the idea of a veil out of your mind. He's talking about hair. He's talking about length of hair. That's what he's talking about here. And so if a man prays or prophesies having his head covered, he dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. And that is one and the same as if her head were shaved. Ah, shaved. Yeah, we're not talking about scarves. We're talking about hair. So if she's got that kind of, if she's going to have an uncovered head in terms of short hair, uncovered, which is symbolic, as he says it here, she is dishonoring her head. For if a woman is not covered, let her be shorn. Shorn, that's another length of hair. Not exactly shaved. You see some guys around, they're shaved. Some guys are shorn. Some of you guys are shorn. I look at you right now, you're shorn. Some people are shaved. That's kind of a style they have today. So, once again, we're talking about that. If she's not covered, let her be shorn. But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. She ought to be covered, he says. For man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is in the image and the glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. It's the same point he made before. Paul's consistent in what he says. He says, he made man in the image of God. The woman was made from man. For the man is not from woman, but the woman is from man. Nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. Now, so he gives a little parenthetical, let's say, insertion there to simply say, look, in one sense, I understand that there's a certain order of things. This does not diminish from the fact in Christ there is an equality, as Paul also later explains in Galatians chapter 2, verse 27, that all are equal in Christ, both men and women. That's not what he's talking about. He's simply talking about something that's going on here that we need to take note of. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol. That's what it is, a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Well, what angels? Well, they're evil angels. Look, we live in a world that's ruled by principalities, by powers, by the evil forces that's described for us. The devil is the prince of the power of the air. Now, if a woman is going to step outside of this, she says, I'm not going to have anybody tell me what to do. I'm not going to be under anybody's authority. God says, go ahead and see what happens to you. Any man does that, see what happens to him too. But long hair is symbolic of the fact that you reside under the authority of the order that God has given, and there is a certain protection that's given to you. And there's a lot of bad things out here that can begin to happen to a person who says, I'm on my own. That kind of rebellious attitude is going to get you in trouble, because you're going to be subject to a lot of very serious things that goes on out here. And what are women a lot subject to? Anything from any kind of emotional problem to being drawn away from the original purpose for which they were, that they have. They can be subject to a lot of other problems. And God says, you need to stay under that authority if you want to be protected from these spiritual forces that are out here. Now, I go to a gym and they got pictures of these tough women. I said, that's fine, I'm not going to fight them. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about not coming under spiritual attack from their enemies. Every single person, even Jesus Christ, needed help with that. And women can't say, well, I'll just kind of bolt and go out and do my own thing. I don't need that. That's what the Women's Lib movement says. We don't need men. All we need is his sperm. That's what they say. We can do it. And so man is pictured then, contrary to that report I just read to you, as totally and completely unnecessary. I think we've got to understand man is necessary. Absolutely necessary. If he really understands, and it works a lot, if he really understands who he is, what he is, and the job he has in God's in God's spiritual economy and spiritual order, man has the responsibility to withstand evil and the false. He needs to do that. This is why men preach. Guys, let's make it real clear. I don't care what you believe. I don't care what you've heard. I don't care what you've changed your mind on from what you used to believe. What the church? I'm telling you this. God set man to preach on his behalf in front of his own congregation. And I don't care what any other church does. This is what happens. Men do this. I suppose you understood what I just said. They're the ones who've got to withstand the evil. Now look, I didn't say women can't preach. I said some don't have the ability to preach. That's what I meant. Women do. Women can give great sermons. I've heard them. They do a wonderful job. I've been in this business for 42 years. You know how many times I've had to, in congregations, I've had to deal with rebellion. I've had to deal with false ideas that have come in. I've had to deal with people, groups of people who come in who want to take the congregation away. And that's happened to me a whole lot more than two times. You gals want that job? I want you to think about that. It's not just being able to get up and preach and say nice things and think everybody's going to like you. You've got to deal with the evil. And the pastor and the minister has as his job to withstand the evil in that congregation. He's also to instruct in the good. Don't get me wrong. I'm just simply giving you another side of it that a lot of people don't see. This is what a man does in his family. Now, abdicate from this man, men, and turn it over to the ladies. You're going to have problems. You're not doing your job. You're not standing under Christ as your head, submitted to Christ, obedient to Christ, and doing the job that you were meant to do. 15 million American children are in homes without fathers. A lot more in homes where their father is there but is checked out emotionally. He's thrown up his hands because he didn't know what to do or wasn't taught himself or has succumbed to society's rules. And somehow the mother has taken over the leadership. She's the dominant person. She's the mover and shaker in the family and the emotional leader and the nurturer of the family. I'm not saying she doesn't have her part, her side. She does, a very good side, and very important and absolutely necessary and indispensable part. She certainly does. But there has been a terrible toll on on American boys and also Australian boys and boys coming up in the Western, in our Western culture. Here's what a man is. A man knows who he is. He knows his purpose. And he knows where he's going. He knows what he wants, and he has the capacity within himself to achieve it and to work against opposing forces if he needs to. What is more important, he has a certain confidence in what he does and what he knows he's able to do. That's what a man is. I can shorten that to one sentence. And people have tried to define masculinity. They've tried to define what a man is and what a man should be. A man knows who he is. It's very simple. A man knows who he is. And he does it without wrath and without doubting. He is secure in his relationship with his God. And he prays. That's why we have the title of the sermon. Real men pray. Now, there are a lot of factors. If you didn't have this kind of upbringing, and more boys don't have this kind of upbringing, unfortunately. We do find young men who, for some reason, can't seem to, they don't. Marriage is something that simply, it's hard to figure out, okay, what, I got to make some decisions here. How do I get established in a relationship? Who am I? Is he secure enough within himself to get into that relationship? What are the issues here? What are the big issues? What does a boy have to deal with? I want to tell you something, religion has a big part of it. The feminist movement is a big part of it. And I want to tell you another big part of it is mothers. And mothers have gone and have done a lot of harm to their own boys. Let me if your confidence as a man has been eroded, or you have somehow been prevented from developing as you should as a man, you were never allowed to be a boy and do what boys do. Maybe this could have been the case. You're never allowed to play aggressively, wrestle, fight, defend yourself, get dirty, get rough, fight your own battles, get sweaty and competitive, do adventurous things, do stupid things. Not protected by their mothers, but nurtured by their fathers, mentored by their fathers, taught and chastised by their fathers. They learn to take the hard knocks of life and they get up again. This is what boys have to learn. That's the kind of life a boy ought to have growing up. But if his mother shames him, his mother tells, I had a friend like this. He used to come out to our house as a teenager. We became friends in high school. He lived in town. We lived in the country. His mother told him, my life was fine till you came along and other bad things. He was not the favorite boy. There was another boy that came along. He was the favorite. He got everything. He couldn't figure it out. He had to deal with this. He had to struggle with it. He had struggled with it all his life. And he tells me later, because I met up with him, he said, you know, your house and coming out to your place and always wondering why he was out there so much. And we had a chicken farm. We had cows. We had everything else. And so he comes out. We put him to work. We shoveled a lot of chicken manure. But he liked it. We got our guns and we went out and we shot things. And we skinned animals. And we did things boys did. We did a lot of things. And he says, that saved me. Because I couldn't stand it around the house. I didn't know that. He tells me this later. I told him, I said, Charlie, I said, your mother had her own demons she was dealing with. I said, yeah, but you know what it does to a boy? You know, he's been through two marriages. He's been through, you know, his kids, you know, they got problems. You know, he had a hard time. Here he is, he's a little younger than me. He's just now getting his life squared away to where he's got things settled. It's a tough go. It's a tough go. Look, moms, you got to know what a boy is. A lot of mothers never know what a boy is, never know what a boy should be, never knows what a boy should do or have to do to be able to become a man and to take his proper place as a man. I think it's terrible. A lot of boys grow up ashamed. They don't know. They're uncertain. They don't have confidence. And they have to fight that battle all their lives. I'll tell you what. It's a lot better to have an overbearing father and a retiring mother than it is to have a father who's checked out and a mother who's on the warpath all the time. I'm telling you, it's a lot better than that. Than just, well, I'll tell you what. The family dynamic sometimes do leave a lot to be desired. Paul says men ought to pray with holy hands, without wrath on one hand, without doubting on the other. Two big issues men have to face. 1 Peter 5, verse 5. You ask me to give a definition in the next five or six verses as to what a man is. Here it is. Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another, be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he might exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him. Resist him. Boys, you know how to resist the evil? You know how to resist someone who's going to be aggressive and who comes at you? You know how to deal with a bully at school? Do you know how? Resist him. We do have to push back. Steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Jesus Christ, after you have suffered a while. Here we come. I've just kind of pulled this out. I think it's a very good definition. After you have suffered a while, perfect you, establish you, strengthen you, and settle you. A man is a man because he knows who he is. He's settled. He is confident in his strength. He's established in who and what he is. He's been perfected. He's suffered. He's taken the hard knocks. He's gotten up. He's fought the fights. He's fought the battles. He's a man, because that's what men do. Why do real men pray? Because they're confident in their relationship with God. They have faced the issues in their lives with him. They have asked the hard questions of God. God has in turn asked of them the hard questions. And they have then the confidence to move as God's emissaries in the world, expecting answers, confident in that relationship, unafraid, not embittered, humbled, yet bold. This is what a man is. My apologies for going to the lower time today.